Welcome to The Water Faucet, quenching your thirst for answers on drinking water. I'm Harry Harmon, a professional engineer with over 45 years' experience. I've designed hundreds of potable water projects which supply drinking water to everyday people just like you. Join me for an exciting voyage of discovery where I will answer your questions about what you deserve most and can't live without: clean, safe, and abundant drinking water. I'm so glad you've joined me for this maiden voyage of the water faucet. In this inaugural episode, I'll discuss a problem that was sent to me by a colleague: blue stains on sinks. But before we get to that, there are a few things that we should cover first. When I began telling friends and coworkers about starting this podcast, they were very encouraging. Many people have questions about their drinking water, especially when you hear about a boil order notice issued by a community or about the lead crisis in Flint or a large portion of Texas without drinking water for weeks after a freak freeze. Incidentally, these topics will be the subject of future episodes. Also, you will hear me occasionally use the term potable water. Potable water and drinking water are the same thing. People deserve to know the truth about their drinking water. They need to have confidence that someone is answering their questions truthfully and without bias or an agenda. There are many water system operators I am proud to call my friends. I know them to be honest, very conscientious, and take pride in the water that they produce. Many times people seek answers from neighbors and friends. But let's be honest, how reliable or knowledgeable are they? So who can you turn to for straight, honest, and unbiased answers? That is why I started the Water Faucet Podcast. Why should you trust my answers? I've spent my entire 45-year professional career studying water, designing and constructing potable water facilities. When necessary, I've investigated problems, helped solve drinking water quality, and water treatment plant operations. In 2019, I received the Educate Award from the Illinois section of the American Water Works Association in recognition for my commitment to education and training operators on a variety of drinking water issues. Now I want to turn that educational effort squarely toward the public, along with anyone else who needs honest answers to questions about their drinking water. So how much experience do I have? I graduated from Purdue University with a bachelor's degree in civil engineering. Environmental engineering was the focus of my studies, specifically water treatment plant design. I realized I wanted to continue in the design field, so I began work at a large environmental consulting firm in 1983, designing all things related to drinking water. I've designed over 100 water treatment plants and countless elevated storage, ground storage, and pumping stations. I've authored numerous studies, reports, and evaluations, and of course, troubleshooting problems with public water supplies has been a major part of my career. Over the years, I've authored and presented technical papers at major national conventions as well as state and local conventions. I've served on two Illinois Section AWWA technical committees, including the Small Water Systems Committee. During my work as a design project manager, I conceived and developed several design innovations which improved the operation of public water supply systems. I've also filed for two patents. Several of my projects have received awards for engineering excellence, including a National Engineering Excellence Award. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of what these blue stains are and what causes them, we need to cover drinking water basics. Most people don't realize how complicated water really is, so they take it for granted. Turn on the faucet and water magically appears, until it suddenly doesn't. Then the simplest acts like getting a drink of water, making ice, brushing your teeth, or flushing a toilet disappear as well. It is only when you no longer have something that you truly begin to appreciate it. Water is so much more than just two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. It is a simple compound, but it is so complex in how it reacts to nature. It's so versatile in nature because it is so simple. Life as we know it would not exist without water and everything that it does. Roughly 3/5 of the surface of the earth is covered with water, and most of that contains too much salt to drink. There seems to be an abundance of water, but there really isn't as much as you might think. Let me give you a visual of just exactly how much water there really is on our planet. If the Earth was the size of a basketball, and if you took all the liquid water on our planet and made it into a ball, the total volume of all the liquid on our planet would only be the size of a ping pong ball. And as I said, most of it is too salty to drink. Water used for the purpose of drinking typically starts with rainwater. Rainwater that enters the ground is called groundwater. Rainwater flowing in streams and rivers we call surface water. Water absorbs minerals called hardness as it travels through the gravels and rocks underground, but it also absorbs contaminant minerals, which must be removed. Surface water also absorbs contaminants as it flows over ground, including bacteria, viruses, parasites, all of which must be inactivated before the water can be classified as potable. We'll discuss the differences between disinfection, inactivation, and sterilization in a later episode. Water is so unique and complex that unlike most other compounds, water expands when it freezes. If you've ever left a bottle of soda pop outside during the winter, you know what happens. Virtually no other compound or element does that. If water shrank when it froze, ice would sink to the bottom of the lakes and ponds and they would freeze from the bottom up. Instead, they freeze from the top down because ice is less dense than the water that it's made from. Further, as you go deeper in a lake or pond, the pressure increases due to the weight of the water above it. This added pressure makes water freeze at a lower temperature, sometimes much lower than 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, if you left a bottle of pop outside in the winter and you were lucky enough to bring it inside before the bottle burst, the contents may appear to be a liquid, but when you open the bottle froze instantly. That is because the added pressure used to keep the fizz, which is carbon dioxide, in solution, kept it from freezing. Release the pressure and the liquid freezes. Because of this action, it is very difficult to freeze solid a deep lake compared to a shallow lake or pond. This is critically important because if lakes or ponds froze solid, many species of aquatic life would perish encased in ice every winter instead of continuing to live in the liquid below the ice layer. Over the years, I've read many articles about corrosion and water. They discuss the relationship between corrosive water and a low pH. Most of these articles were written by non-engineers or non-scientists who believe the water needs to have a low pH, like an acid, to dissolve or corrode metals. Water can corrode metals even when the pH is above 8.0, given the right conditions. One of the first things that I was taught at Purdue is that water is the universal solvent, meaning virtually everything will dissolve into water, pH notwithstanding. Pure water, like deionized water, has a pH of 7, and it will dissolve or absorb virtually anything. If you're not sure what pH is, it is a scale which ranges from 1 to 14, representing how acid or how alkali a liquid is. Technically, it is a scale of how much hydrogen ions there are in a liquid. A pH of 1 is a very strong acid. Examples of acids are sulfuric acid, which has a pH of 2.75, and carbonic acid, which has a pH of 4.68. Stomach acid has a pH ranging from 1.5 to 3.5. A pH of 14 is a very strong alkali, also known as a base. Examples of a base are caustic soda or lye, which has a pH of 13, and baking soda, which has a pH of 10. A pH of 7 is considered neutral, neither an acid nor an alkali. Pure water, like deionized water, has a pH of 7 because there is a balance of hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions, H and OH, or H2O. Water molecules form a matrix. Because water does not like being pure, it wants to absorb anything and everything it can to fill the spaces in that matrix. Different compounds and metals dissolve into water at different rates. We see this happen every day and we don't even give it a second thought. Things like sugar dissolve so quickly that we can actually see it happening. Place a piece of iron in water, and in a few days, you can see that it's corroding or dissolving into the water. And how about this factoid? A single gallon of water weighs 8.3 pounds, but it can absorb 2.5 pounds of salt, almost one-third of its weight, into the water matrix. Things like gold and silver are known as noble metals. They exist in nature in their pure form. For a long time, it was thought it would not dissolve into water. However, I recently learned that specialized type of water testing equipment can now measure even minute traces of metals in samples of seawater. It has found most metals that appear on the periodic table, including gold. The average amount of gold dissolved in seawater is 10 parts per trillion. That's with a T. In other words, each 1 trillion gallons of seawater contains 10 pounds of gold. Amazingly, this means that even gold, one of nature's most stable and inert metals, does dissolve into water, if only in very minute quantities. The only thing that keeps water from absorbing metals into its matrix is how full the matrix is with other things, like hardness, which is primarily calcium and magnesium. Think of the water matrix like a shopping mall parking lot, and cars are their metal ions. When the lot is empty, cars can freely find a place to park. When the lot starts to get full, cars must drive around and around in search of one of the few remaining spots. If the water matrix is relatively empty, like deionized water, ions can easily find a place in the matrix, so we consider it corrosive. As the matrix starts to be filled with other ions, regardless of what they are, there are fewer spaces to accept free ions, and the water is less corrosive. If enough spaces are filled, water may no longer be considered corrosive because it takes too long for free ions to find a space in the water matrix. When the matrix can hold no more ions, we consider it saturated. Water has an amazing response to temperature. Warming water increases the amount of ions that can be held by the matrix, like adding more parking spaces. As water cools, the number of parking spaces decreases. Did you ever try to make sugar crystals by heating water to near boiling and adding sugar? You can keep adding sugar into warm water until it no longer absorbs sugar. When sugar can no longer be absorbed in warm water, it means that the parking spaces are filled and the water is saturated. Let the water cool and you start forming crystals, which grows as the liquid cools closer to room temperature. We call this supersaturation. If you've ever noticed white particles in your glass of ice water, they are probably calcium precipitating because the cold water can no longer provide a home for calcium. So what does this have to do with what causes the blue or blue-green stains? The blue stains are copper that remain when standing water evaporates. It may only be a few copper atoms at a time, but if the surface of the sink is left moist after use, when that moisture evaporates, the copper remains, and the blue color increases every time you use the sink. The same thing occurs with calcium. Calcium can remain when the moisture evaporates. Calcium produces a white stain, or what is known as hard water stains. Why is copper in the water? The simple answer is it does not come in with the water from your provider. It comes from the copper in your home's water pipes. The EPA's lead and copper rule was implemented to reduce the corrosivity of water to prevent lead and copper from being absorbed into the water from pipes and pipe fittings. The primary concern is from the water service between the water main and the house and from the pipes inside the house. Basically, the EPA's goal has always been no lead in drinking water and to reduce the amount of copper such that people who are genetically disposed to Wilson's disease do not get any more copper from the water than possible. Some copper in our diets is beneficial, but too much can cause health problems. The EPA recognizes that water is the universal solvent and changes must be made to the water chemistry of some to make it non-corrosive. This would entail adjusting the water chemistry by increasing the alkalinity, changing the pH, or adjusting the calcium concentration. The idea is to fill the water matrix so it can no longer accept free lead or copper ions. I'll talk about the Langelier Saturation Index, or LSI, which can be used to determine a water's pH of saturation or pH of stability in a later episode. The testing associated with the lead and copper rule is to determine the effectiveness of the corrosion prevention program used by your water provider. Under normal conditions, water does not remain in contact with pipes long enough to absorb enough lead or copper to show up using standard analytical equipment. It is thought that normal activities such as showering, flushing toilets, or letting the water run a little while to get rid of the stagnant water inside the faucet uses enough water to flush the system in the morning or any other time of day. In order to get a water sample that might contain enough lead or copper to be measured, the EPA establishes an artificial condition for getting a water sample. Water must remain motionless in the pipe for at least 6 hours. Then, a first draw water sample is taken and tested for lead and copper. If the concentration of lead and copper are below the EPA action limits, then the corrosion prevention program is working. If the concentration is higher than the action limit, adjustments must be made to the program to reduce the corrosivity of water. State and federal regulations allow public water supplies to use a corrosion inhibitor rather than reducing the corrosivity of the water. At the water plant, a phosphate-based inhibitor is added to the water, which is supposed to coat the interior of the pipes in your house, so water does not come in contact with the actual metal. The problem is, you need to run a lot of water through pipes to build up and maintain a sufficiently thick coating. Coating the inside of these pipes sounds simple to accomplish, but it is not, because the majority of the corrosion inhibitor added at the water treatment plant never comes in contact with the water pipes, but just flows through the middle of pipes. There are two important terms that need clarification: flow rate and velocity. While they sound like the same thing, they are very different. Flow rate is a volume of water flowing through the pipe and is expressed as gallons per minute. Velocity is how fast that volume is traveling through the pipe, typically expressed as feet per second. Water does not flow through a pipe at a uniform speed or velocity. The speed varies from slow next to the walls and fast in the middle of the pipe. Why does water flow slower at the walls? Believe it or not, it is friction between the pipe wall and the water in contact with the wall. When engineers talk about the velocity of water flowing through a pipe, we're really talking about the average velocity from the slowest at the walls to the fastest in the middle of the pipe. And it's the water in the middle of the pipe that is carrying most of the corrosion inhibitor. But it is the walls that must be coated. Most homes use half-inch copper pipes, while some homes use 3/4, 1-inch, or larger diameter pipes to distribute water to the faucets. The larger diameter pipe is intended to reduce the velocity in the pipe, which reduces the friction at the walls and increases pressure by increasing the volume of water in the middle of the pipe. When the pipe diameter doubles from 1/2 inch to 1 inch, it is like going from a one-lane road, then adding a second lane and making the road a double-decker highway with 4 lanes. If the flow rate through the two pipes is the same because of the downstream valves, the average velocity in the 1-inch pipe is only 1/4 that of the 1/2-inch pipe. Lower velocities mean less friction, but higher velocities in pipe mean turbulence, and turbulence creates mixing. It is this mixing which distributes the corrosion inhibitor in the middle of the pipe to the walls, so it replenishes the inhibitor being left on the pipe walls. Without turbulence, there is less inhibitor coating the walls and more corrosion inhibitor remaining in the middle of the pipe. Valves are used to control the flow of water leaving the pipe. These include your faucet and the valve that controls how quickly your toilet storage tank refills after a flush. You may not have noticed, but most faucets use only a 3/8-inch pipe to connect the faucet to whatever copper size pipe feeds them. The 3/8-inch pipe is measured from the outside of the pipe, so there is only a 1/4-inch diameter opening in the middle carrying water to the point of use. The flow rate is generally limited to between 3 and 4 gallons per minute. The combination of controlled flow rate and larger pipes means it takes much more water flowing through the pipes to establish the necessary coating. Engineers design distribution systems to avoid dead ends whenever possible. Every dead end is a place where water can sit motionless for long periods, which affects water quality. Your community probably has a water main flushing program performed once or twice a year to clean these dead ends and generally clean water mains. Every faucet in your home creates a dead end. If these are not flushed regularly, the water can sit long enough to allow the water to absorb copper and possibly lead from the pipe walls and joints. This non-moving water, also known as stagnant water, can lose chlorine residual and generally degrade the water quality. This means it is important for you to regularly flush sink faucets, showers, and toilets, especially in guest bathrooms and fixtures not generally used. What does this mean for you and your home? If water remains in contact with your copper pipes long enough and there isn't a thick enough coating of corrosion inhibitor on the walls because of larger diameter pipes or lack of use, then copper, even in minute quantities and probably less than the EPA's action limit, can be absorbed into the water. Every time you use your sink, if the surface remains moist after use, a few atoms of copper will remain as the moisture evaporates. Eventually, the amount of copper increases, leaving a blue stain. You may have to flush your pipes more frequently to build up a sufficient coating. Especially if the pipes are large enough, you may need to flush your pipes more frequently to build up a sufficiently thick coating of the corrosion inhibitor, especially if your pipes are larger than the standard 1/2 inch typically used in most homes. Also, drying your sink surface after use will help keep blue stains or hard water stains from forming. That does it for this episode of The Water Faucet. Email your questions, concerns, and comments to thewaterfaucetpodcast@gmail.com. Remember, when you're over your head in deep water, just keep treading forward until you find solid ground. Until next time, I'm Harry Harmon for The Water Faucet.